Welcome to the Real Vision Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. It's Wednesday, December 1st, 2021. I'm Ash Bennington, joined today by Darius Dale. Let's just jump right in here. Obviously, a lot happening, lots to talk about. The first Omicron case detected in the United States, probably no surprise to anyone. Nonetheless, U.S. equity markets reverse their earlier gains and sell off. Looks like the S&P is off about 1.2% on the day. NASDAQ looks like the big loser, off almost 1.83%. NASDAQ, right now, S&P 500 trading at 4,512 as we head into the close right now. U.S. equity markets have really been, let's just call them very active since Friday. News coming from Jay Powell yesterday, Fed Chair Jay Powell on the Hill, talking about the potential to withdraw the accommodation via the taper more quickly than originally planned, and also potentially retiring the word transitory. Obviously, some very big news. Couldn't have a better person here to talk about this with us, to bring us into his macro worldview. Darius Dale, welcome back to the show.
Ash, what's up, man? How's it going?
Oh, man, you tell me, what's your view of everything that's happening here? We talked about it a little bit at the top of the show, incredibly active time. What's the framework saying? What are your gauges saying right now, Darius?
Well, I like to start with some pockets of humor, because obviously we got a little volatility in markets today to discuss and unpack. But I find it funny that the phrase transitory ultimately proved to be transitory and not inflation, which is pretty funny. That's neither here nor there. I mean, poor Powell, he's in a really tough spot respect to their dual mandate. But that's neither here nor there. So obviously, you know, Omicron is causing a lot of financial market volatility. I would argue the Fed's accelerated tape, confirming what we've always thought would be an accelerated tapering timeframe. At least not always. Sorry, going back to a few weeks ago, thought that'd be an accelerated tapering timeframe. And so that, the confluence of, you know, a potential slowdown in growth, you know, from a post Delta bounce that we called out going back to August, in the heading into a Fed tightening event, you know, as soon as potentially June of next year, I think markets are certainly concerned about that. But there's some reasons to be positive. There's some reasons to be cautious, and we can unpack those reasons.
Yeah. By the way, you just said something there, Darius, in passing, that I think really is the core of everything we're talking about right now, the bind that Jay Powell is in. You mentioned the dual mandate, this notion of trying to maximize for two different variables, optimize, I should say, for two different variables, stable employment and stable prices, I should say, maximal employment and stable prices. This is really a difficult bind in this situation, because they both seem to be under threat simultaneously. Give us the framework for what that means and how you're looking at it.
Yeah, no. So look, the Fed clearly going back to August of 2020 pivoted to a maximum and inclusive employment and labor shortfall with respect to their Fed, their growth mandate. And obviously they had to adjust their inflation mandate to accommodate that, to allow the economy to effectively overheat on purpose to sort of get the labor market back to what Powell would characterize as some pretty buoyant conditions, you know, prior to the pandemic. So there's some thing, you know, so with respect to those dynamics, you know, the employment to population ratio is still 230 basis points off of its, you know, pre-COVID high. The prime working age labor force participation ratio is down 130 basis points off of its pre-COVID high. And then ultimately, the female labor force participation rate, which is probably the most important statistic that's impacted by COVID, still down 180 basis points from its pre-COVID high. So, you know, I think that there's the doves on the FOMC are very much looking at those data sets and saying, right, hey, look, we have to be patient, because if we start to remove accommodation from the economy at this particular juncture, we're effectively stranding behind millions of Americans and trapping them out of the labor force and trapping them out of the employment markets. And that's obviously not a good thing. But the reality is the hawks on the Fed board, and really it's not even the hawks, it's really the data, the reacceleration in inflation, particularly in the month of November, was a big deal. I mean, on a SAR basis, headline CPI accelerated back to 12%. On a SAR basis, that's the highest number we've seen since June 08. But more importantly, core PCE accelerated. This is October data that we got a few weeks ago or last week. Core PCE accelerated to 5% on a SAR basis. That's the highest number we've seen in a few months. So we have been trending down with respect to the sequential momentum in inflation. But that uptick in October, in the October data set, both on the headline, core PCE, all those types of metrics that the Fed are looking at, they do have to, it's likely that they have to do something different come 12/15 or December 15th.
Yeah. Well, that's it in a nutshell right there. That's the bind. That's the dilemma. Inflation accelerating at 5% on PCE, cited by Jay Powell on the Hill yesterday, well above the 2% longer run mandate. Meanwhile, simultaneously, the point that you make about the damage, the destruction to the labor market, something that's really so core to everything we're talking about. We're talking about the labor force participation rate. This is a series called CivPART, C-I-V-P-A-R-T, on the St. Louis Fed FRED website. And boy, is it an ugly chart. This reminds me of what Ed Harrison, our old friend, used to talk about as the inverse radical sign. It basically, you see it kind of chugging along like this, declining a little bit, then a wickedly steep drop, right? This is what happens when you close an economy because of the virus. Then you see the equally rapid recovery, but guess what? It doesn't get back up to par. It doesn't get up to where it should be. And then it just goes sideways again at the newer, lower level. This is something that really is devastating to people who are in that position, people who have exited the labor force. You know, maybe someone in their early 60s who plan to work for another 6 or 7 years, and they decide they have no choice but to retire. All of these very difficult trade-offs, job level. You see the same thing as you do with the civilian labor force participation rate. Talk to you a little bit about what that means and how you measure it.
Yeah, absolutely. This is something I unpacked in great detail in the long form discussion I did with Stephen Van Meter, I want to say in October. And the reality is there's a lot of dynamics that are causing friction in the labor market. And this happens in every cycle. There's always a set of hysteresis that develop in the labor market. Right. And as a function of that, the Fed typically has to be, you know, pretty slow removing the punch bowl in the early start of in the early phase of an economic expansion. So clearly you have the retirement dilemma with respect to COVID. Obviously, female labor force participation is a big deal. You have household net worth being extremely elevated. One metric we track is household net worth as a percent of disposable personal income. And that's basically about 780, basically eight or nine times higher than a ratio of disposable personal income. That's an all-time high. So you might have two job households transitioning to one and a half job households as well. And right. then ultimately there's the geographic mismatch. People are moving to places where they may or may not be able to, work in the same industry. And then also there's just a skills mismatch as well, as we continue to see. And this is something that's persisted throughout the previous cycle. And so you layer on all those things with the labor market that is, kind of in that part of the phase where it's going to continue to improve slowly. And albeit, I will say the ADP data this morning were pretty robust. But again, it's part of the part of the sign curve where we were going to bounce. It's a November data point. We accelerated 20 basis points to 4.5% year over year. That's the highest number I think we've seen in about 4 or 5 months. So that's a good data point. We're continuing to pull those people back into the kiddie pool that is the U.S. labor market. But the speed with which we do that is likely to slow down as a fundamental reason for a number of factors. One, we have a declining fiscal impulse, and one that could actually accelerate to the downside to the extent the Biden agenda gets derailed, as I continuously think, or as I increasingly believe it may, with respect to Senator Manchin and Senator Sinema not playing ball as a function of all this high inflation. And then two, you have steepening base effects for growth. You obviously have less policy accommodation from the Monetary Policy Authority. And so you kind of look out into the world in 2022, and I think the big issue for markets, and it may not be a big issue for markets today, but I do believe at some point in the next 3 to 6 months, it will be a very big deal for markets, is the fact that growth expectations, both domestically and globally, remain extremely elevated. Now, they're talking about a U.S. economy growing 4% on a real GDP basis next year. And in the context of everything I just said, I struggle to get to those numbers. I mean, that's the reality. I think that's something the bond market has clearly looked out and into. If you look at the long end of the curve flattening, break to new lows in the 30-year, I think that's something that investors are certainly weighing and increasingly being forced to consider.
Yeah, boy, that's so well framed, Darius. I think that's really the crux of the issue when we talk about labor markets, and you've expanded upon it in a really, I think, illuminating way, so that we try and get our heads around what's happening here. You said something at the very beginning of that answer, an SAT word, hysteresis. This is such an interesting point. It's something that comes up in physics, in chemistry, but it's actually kind of a simple idea. It's basically you have inputs and you have outputs, and at a certain point, when things in the system get out of whack, the outputs stop responding to the inputs. So even as the causes change, the effects don't then follow. Tell us a little bit about the role that hysteresis plays in U.S. labor markets when we have a crisis like the one we saw during COVID.
Yeah, so this is exactly the point that everyone makes when they're sort of buying early cycle cyclicals at the bottom of a recession in the stock market and the credit markets is because of that labor market hysteresis. The growth impulse that tends to catalyze higher labor is not it's not a one-to-one transmission mechanism during recession, immediately after recession in the early part of the recovery.
Right.
So you do get this, you know, kind of explosion in profitability in the corporate sector as a function of that hysteresis. But then as it, you know, as you march throughout time, you know, the labor market really starts to heal, and it heals at a much slower pace typically than the improvement in the economy as you progress into the mid-cycle. And then later cycle, you kind of hand the baton off from the growth dynamics to the labor market dynamics. And that's typically when the labor market peaks. It's obviously how the MBER and the BEA catalyzers or you know, kind of identify recessions. So that's neither here nor there. But this is the process we're in. Now, yeah. You know, I think we're still early in the expansion phase of the discussion. It's just that the shape of the expansion as a function of Omicron and potentially as a function of a Fed acknowledging and acquiescing a policy rate tightening expectation by the middle of next year, you know, the shape of that expansion might be a little bit different than investors thought, you know, maybe going 3 or 4 weeks ago.
Yeah, Darius, you just explained hysteresis much better than my Econ 101 teacher did, I can assure you. But listen, you talk about these phases.
Google.com is a lot better than Yale and, you know, wherever you studied economics, trust me.
We're going to take a quick break and be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PI, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcasts, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Welcome back to Real Vision's Daily Briefing. Let's get right back to the top analysis of today's markets.
Well, you had a whole lot more PhDs and Nobel Prize winners in economics at Yale than I did where I was. But listen, let me ask you this. As you talk about these phases, these phase transitions, tell us where we are right now in your grid view of the world and unpack for people who may not be familiar with it, how that foresees, analyzes, and explains what's happening in an economy.
Yeah, great question. So for those of you who are new, we've analyzed the world in regime segmentation fashion, thinking about Goldilocks, where growth's accelerating and inflation's decelerating relative to reflation, what we call, that's when growth and inflation are accelerating simultaneously. There's growth and growth decelerating, inflation accelerating. That's what we call inflation. Many of you will call that stagflation. And then lastly, what we call deflation, that's where growth and inflation are decelerating simultaneously. And so you think about the progression over the last few weeks and months. You know, we bounced into this reflation regime where the markets are pricing in reflation, and partially as a function of that, we do believe, the markets are pricing in reflation, and our belief as a function of the post-Delta bounce in economic activity that we continue to observe. Obviously, we got some very strong ADP data this morning, very strong ISM data this morning that we can unpack that as well. And so did have that post-Delta bounce, and we did have that mini reflation trade that we called for going back to September. The reality is the markets started to price that out going back to the early part of November, and has officially priced that out as recently as last week, the early part of last week, in transitioning to what we call, again, inflation. That's stagflation. That's where the market is pricing in accelerating growth and decelerating inflation. In terms of the pivots that investors need to make, you know, our process really anchors on understanding, you know, how asset markets, what creates dispersion in asset markets across those regimes through the lens of volatility, covariance, expected returns, percent positive ratios. And there's some pretty key takeaways in terms of, you know, when you pivot from reflation to inflation, from an equity style factors perspective, you go from being overweight high beta cyclicals and small caps to being underweight those things. From an equity sector perspective, when you pivot from reflation to inflation, you go from being overweight industrials, financials, energy, to being underweight those things. And then lastly, within the fixed income markets, you go from being overweight things like BDCs, convertibles, preferreds, high yield credit, to being underweight those things. And so that's part of the process, part of the volatility we're seeing in the last couple of weeks, you know, since going back to last Friday, in our opinion, is the market reacting to that phase transition in macro market dynamics that our process, you know, spotted a few weeks ago and started the position for a few weeks ago. So a lot of investors came into this, you know, and came into the Omicron news, came into the tapering news, long of a reflation portfolio, and they didn't get the memo that they should have transitioned to something that looks more like inflation.
Yeah, that's such a crisp explanation and connection between, on the one hand, the state of the macro economy as your gauges and dials tell you as you monitor it on the one hand, and on the other, the sectoral analysis of what's happening in U.S. equities. We're going to get to that in just one second, but you did mention one other thing that I wanted you to unpack, which is the ISM Manufacturing Index. Obviously, manufacturing continuing to accelerate. Give us your sense on what's happening there and how it plays into your grid view.
Yeah, absolutely. So right now, from a bottom up, so what I just taught, everything I just said was talking about the market regime. What's the market pricing in through the lens of what we call our global macro risk matrix, which looks at the 42 most liquid, you know, kind of most widely followed market indicators in the world through the perspective of our volatility adjusted momentum signal. From a bottom up perspective, in terms of what the economy is actually doing, inflation is still the most probable outcome, the highest realized outcome. For the U.S. and global economies with respect to the next 3 months, that transitions to deflation, growth slowing, inflation slowing. When you look, you know, kind of in the 3 to 6 month out view right now, the 1 to 3 month forward view is inflation. The 3 to 6 month out view is deflation. And so, you know, when I look at the ISM manufacturing PMI data, you know, when I look at any data, I'm looking to see if it's confirming our model's forecast or if it's disconfirming our model's forecast. And the reality is they're all being fed into the nowcast, so it doesn't really matter. But, you know, from a color commentating perspective, the number one data point, I said this in my macro minute this morning, the number one data point we need to be looking for in the ISM manufacturing print for this month, for November, is the percentage of respondents reporting slower supply delivery times. We made the thesis that, hey, you know, we might be moving past peak supply chain disruptions in the U.S. economy, in the global economy, particularly as we move kind of past this pulled forward holiday season. And that we're starting to get incremental evidence of that. That percentage of respondents reporting slower supplier delivery times, that takes down to 48.2. That's the lowest number we've seen in a few months. So that's a good thing, in so much that the ISM prices index ticked down to 82.4. That's the lowest number we've seen in a couple of months. So as it relates to, you know, going down that path and marching towards, you know, inflation slowing on a trending basis, growth slowing on a trending basis, which again is our process, we call that deflation. That is something that's increasingly likely as it go according to today's data.
Yeah, well, that is really the perfect segue you just set me up with here to square the circle and continue the narrative with what's happening from the macro economy into what's happening in these equity markets. Talk a little bit about the sector analysis, the sector breakdown, and how that maps on to the grids you've just described.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I guess the key takeaway, you know, when you're going from Goldilocks or reflation, which are pro-growth environments, as where growth is accelerating in both, to an inflation or deflation environment, that's where growth is decelerating in both of those regimes. You know, there's some pretty obvious pivots you make. I mentioned the reflation pivots. But when you go from an inflation to a deflation, that lateral pivot, you don't need to make as many changes in your portfolio. You do need to take down your overall risk with respect to how much equity and credit beta you have. But the reality is the sectors, the style factors that you tend to be want to be overweight and underweight are generally the same, in so much that kind of the fixed income sectors that you want to be allocated to and out of tend to be very much the same as well. So that's not a difficult pivot for investors to risk manage. Issue is that they came into this last Friday's smackdown and this week's smackdowns being long of reflation. And that's the issue with the asset markets right now. And so, you know, there's an opportunity for asset markets to fully, you know, for investors to sort of, you know, finish out that pivot. Because again, let's take a step back from everything here. The Fed is still going to buy $90 billion or $85 billion of bonds this month. You know what I mean? Like, let's keep that in our back of our head. You know, they're talking about accelerating the taper to get them to a potential June rate hike scenario. Yeah. It's December 1st. You know what I mean? Like, let's not be too carried away with respect to tapering and monetary policy tightening. There's certainly legs to this bull market from a net liquidity perspective. If you isolate that factor, it's very unlikely that net liquidity provision inflects lower, which it should take the S&P lower, should take risk assets lower. It's very unlikely that it inflects lower until at least the latter part of Q1, the early part of Q2. And so that tells you from that perspective alone, from the policy, from the liquidity that got us here, from the punch bowl that we're all punch happy drunk on, that is not changing anytime soon with respect to the asset market's ability to continue higher. What is potentially changing, obviously, is Omicron, its impact on the economy, particularly through the lens of vaccines that may or may not be effective. That is something that investors are a little bit worried for. And also the fiscal policy dynamics we're kind of inching closer to D-Day, although there's some estimates that that Yellen could potentially extend the debt ceiling into January. So that may be less of a catalyst in the near term.
So let's continue that narrative to other risk asset markets. We talked about U.S. equities. You framed it up tightly there in terms of this correspondence, the grids. Give us an explanation of how you're thinking right now about fixed income, about bond prices, and also about commodities and currencies.
Yeah, absolutely. So bonds are overbought here, in our opinion, and really, our probable range model's opinion. So that's good. You know, we were adequately positioned for bonds in the 42 macro portfolio construction since going back to a few weeks ago. And so that's been a good trade. But the reality is, on a medium-term basis, there's some pretty obvious asset allocation decisions that you need to make as an investor, whether you're running the world's largest hedge fund or whether you're running the world's smallest personal account or retirement account. When you're at the peak of the growth and inflation sine curves, you don't sell bonds and talk about inflationista this or bond yields are going to 5% or the depth at 60-40. Like that's you have those conversations as a prudent investor before bond yields go up, before inflation gets to the peak of the sine curve, before growth gets to the peak of its sine curve. When you're at the peaks of the sine curve, you do well to read Danny Kahneman's new book, Noise. Stick your fingers in your ear and just make the calm, most likely highest probability asset allocation decisions that you need to make, which is I need to take up my exposure to bonds and defensive assets and take down my exposure to higher beta risk assets at the margins. And more importantly, within the risk asset bets that I'm making in the context of the portfolio, I need to be in more liquid exposures, more defensive exposures. And that's something we've been talking about since going back to a few weeks ago. So to us, that pivot was starting to become very obvious within the confines of our process and all the data-driven signals that we make. But I think it's becoming very obvious, unfortunately, in the wrong way to a lot of other investors.
Yeah, extremely well said. By the way, continuing that narrative, talking about markets, one of the things that I enjoy most about being at Real Vision is the way that we cover cryptocurrency as a macro asset class in a way that I don't think others have really quite caught onto yet. I wanted to take a quick look at a clip. This is actually a conversation that I had with Chris Perkins, president of CoinFund, out today. This is free to everyone. All you have to do is go to realvision.com to sign up. It's on our Real Vision crypto tier, which again is free to everyone. Let's take a look at that clip.
It's obvious to me that current law and regulation just doesn't contemplate the technology that we're seeing. It's operating in a world that extends beyond. Of course it does, because the vast preponderance of our laws and regulations come from 1933. The Howey test comes from 1946. It just doesn't contemplate. And so when I'm very sympathetic to the position that regulators are in right now, because their job is to enforce laws and enforce law and statute.
Well, there you have it. First of all, if you haven't seen this conversation yet, it's an incredible personal journey. Chris Perkins' story about how he got into the crypto space, his life before, a fascinating conversation that you can only hear on Real Vision right now. But I wanted to talk a little bit more broadly about the points that he was making. One of the things that I really enjoyed about this conversation with Chris is that he's framing this context, this conversation, much broader than many people are, talking about this transition that we're in, laws that were formed in the 1930s to address challenges with the Great Depression being inadequate to kind of describe, foresee, understand the crypto digital asset universe, and how we're going to transition to an environment where these markets, the digital asset markets, become much more tightly integrated into what's happening in risk asset markets more generally, but also into what's happening from a global macro perspective. I know this is something that you're curious about, that you think about a great deal, Darius. Talk about the collision of global macro and cryptocurrency / digital assets.
Yeah, no, we've fully integrated cryptocurrency into our macro risk management framework. I mean, it doesn't live out there as this esoteric asset class with respect to how we think about investing. It's very much part of the menu of investment exposures or the menu of investment products that you could have to represent various views and themes in your portfolio. The reality is that in crypto specifically, you tend to get paid very much when you're in Goldilocks and inflation to a lesser degree when you're in inflation, and the general death knell for crypto, as it is for most risk assets, is when you're in deflation, when growth and inflation are decelerating simultaneously. So, very much, yeah, we back tested through the same lens, through the same robust metrics, and ultimately understand, you know, how to position for that, you know, within the context of our risk management system. So yeah, definitely, you know, been a crypto bull. I'll say this, you know, you can fact check me on this, because I believe I said this in October of 2020, I said, bullish on crypto, you know, this is going to be, there's going to be a huge institutional adoption story over the next year as, you know, inflation kind of gets out of hand. But the reality is the more crypto becomes institutionally adopted by people like me, by people like the big hedge funds that we serve at 42 Macro, like the big mutual funds and pension funds that we serve, it's going to start to trade like everything else. So that covariance, that benefit of diversification that you would typically get from an asset class that has historically been very uncorrelated with other asset classes, is only going to get increasingly correlated. So what that means for all you crypto people out there, you're going to need to figure out how the rest of us invest, because you're going to start to get blindsided increasingly by market moving events that you have no idea why they happened. In so much that when we first started investing in crypto, certainly myself, there'd be these big wild price movements. And I'm like, I have no idea what just happened. Why is this thing up 5 or 10% over the weekend? I think that with people who are native to that crypto community are going to increasingly find themselves at the mercy of these other larger institutional players that are coming in trying to have strategic stakes in this asset class. So I think it's a great opportunity for everyone to sort of cross the aisle, if you will, and start to do more research on, you know, the fundamental drivers of crypto, the microeconomic drivers of crypto, as well as the macroeconomic drivers of markets as a whole.
We're going to take another quick break and be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Welcome back to Real Vision's Daily Briefing. Let's get right back to the top analysis of today's markets.
Boy, I'm smiling right now, Darius, because I think we just got a clip for social media there. I mean, that's such a profound and powerful statement. The idea that folks who are in the crypto space are going to have to get a sense of some of the macro issues that you're talking about. You set it up, you framed it so tightly there, so crisply. This idea that cryptocurrency benefits during particular regimes, specifically during Goldilocks and reflation to a lesser extent during inflationary times, and has a challenge during deflation. That's an incredibly crisp formula.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's don't thank me. Thank the crispness of math, man. That's the beauty of the whole process. It's all data driven. It's all quantitative. And it allows us to make, you know, high probability bets at every interval. No, we're not going to get everything right. I think that'd be a misnomer to suggest we do. We're on a hot streak right now. But the reality is we're always going to know why we're doing what we're doing. And we're always going to know why we are taking the highest probability bets at every interval. That will set you up for success over the long term much better than, you know, doing something not that.
Well, we can thank you too, because it's a really cool narrative, and it gives us a way to talk about it in a way that maybe mathematics is great at making those predictive analytics, but to actually have a conversation here, understand the narrative about why crypto trades the way it does on a global scale, basically not talking about this or that protocol experiencing this or that technical problem or advance, but to understand the macro context, crypto as a macro asset class. Boy, this is just in its infancy, and I just don't feel like there are a whole lot of other people having this conversation that you and I are having right now anywhere else.
Yeah, no, look, you're spot on. I have these conversations with institutional investors. I just don't, you know, I don't think there's a lot of there's not enough institutional investors yet to have these conversations out, you know, out loud.
Right.
I think they're still very much in the process of getting things approved by compliance, being forced by their clients, you know, particularly in the high net worth space, to kind of, you know, adopt crypto and create these products and instruments. But the reality is, in terms of actually weaving into a real strategic or tactical asset allocation framework, you know, most of the conversations I have are really around, okay, how do we actually do that? Seems like you've actually built a process around helping you do that, helping other people do that. Let's unpack that. How does it fit into you know, portfolio construction, things of that nature. So those conversations are being had. It's just, you know, I do believe that that is the growth of the industry. It's like a growth of the space of this growth of that whole kind of, you know, ecosystem, if you will. That's something that's going to be ongoing over the next few years.
Yeah, I think those conversations are being had via Zoom calls between you and hedge funds and maybe in some fancy boardrooms here in Midtown. But the idea that we can bring this conversation, I think, to a broader group of people, I think it's incredibly exciting and it's fun to be involved in that. Talking of which, broadening the conversation, lots of questions for you, Darius, coming into us. Let's just jump right in no particular order here. This one comes from Ralph Humphrey from The Exchange. Boy, this is a question that you may not agree with the presupposition of, but it's certainly a view that's out there. So I'm curious to hear how you respond. Ralph wants to know, perhaps a tad cynically, which central banks are the worst three in the world?
Oh, clearly Turkey is number one. They're extremely bad at central banking. They're not a central bank. They're a government that has a, you know, CBT moniker. So you can put them in there. Number two, I would argue, the Argentine central bank, you know, they consistently get it wrong in terms of the understanding the market implied pricing of the currency relative to what the spot rate the spot rate is. And let me see, I would maybe say Brazil too. They're typically very, you know, kind of late to the inflation impulses in the economy. They tend to react to them, but they're always, you know, they generally are pretty late. And more importantly, they need to do a whole, this is a very esoteric discussion, but they need to do a whole rework of their entire financial sector because, you know, the sell-off rate is very disconnected from, you know, the rates that are realized in the economy and the mortgage space and the consumer space and things of that nature. So they got a whole lot of work to do to get up to speed as it relates to modern central banking. But if I had to pick three, and if you, I guarantee you right now, without even having to open my Bloomberg, those are probably the three currencies in the world with the highest volatility on the trailing 3, 5, 10 year basis.
Yeah, well, we know on a 3, 5, 10 day basis, Turkey is certainly in the pole position on that in terms of volatility. Listen, let me ask you this. Talk to us a little bit about banks, central banks in the industrialized world and how you handicap them. Let's talk here about the Fed, BOE, BOJ, and ECB, some of the main central banks, and how you think about the job that they're doing.
I think they're all doing a pretty decent job. I mean, I think the BO, the Bank of England, is what I would sort of take out of that mix. You know, the ECB has done a really decent job. The Bank of Japan has done a really decent job. And by and large, up until the last couple of months, the Fed has done an excellent job. I mean, to say that to see where we are as an economy, going back to the fear we had when we were taping our gloves and last March and putting, you know, boxes over our heads to go to the grocery store, like, and to think about where we are, you know, kind of 18 months later, it's pretty remarkable. And so you do have to, you know, tip your cap to Jay Powell and the committee there for, you know, helping facilitate that. Through obviously easy money and keeping the credit markets open. So they've done a good job. Bank of Japan's done a good job. ECB's done a good job. UK, the Bank of England, it's a bit different story because, you know, their current account deficit nation that imports a lot of their, you know, consumable goods, their, you know, consumable services. And the reality is it's they have a different setup. You know, they're always going to experience a little bit more inflation pressure in these types of environments than other, you know, than their core European counterparts. And so kind of the mismanagement or the lack of understanding of that heading into, you know, this inflation cycle, in our opinion, is one reason to give them a kind of a timeout or a slap on the wrist.
Yeah. Hey, Darius, I know you and I could talk for about 6 hours here about all of these topics. We're starting to run out of time, but I wanted to go to one more question. This one comes to us from Hugh M. This comes to us from The Exchange. This is Real Vision's internal social media network. Hugh M. is obviously someone who is very read into your grid view of the world. And he says, Darius, I believe you continue to lean into inflation in your market regime. Can you please juxtapose this with the recent dramatic decline in WPTI and the pending impact this will have on CPI, consumer price index, going forward? Thanks.
Yeah, most people don't realize this, but, you know, when you back test these things, you know, so there's so much, I said this in my interview with Tony, there's a bubble in narrative-based investing. You know, there's so much money sloshing around, heading into the equity market, heading into the commodity market, heading into the crypto space as a function of the checks we all got, as a function of markets going up, compounding and creating profits. You know, so it's never been easier to make money in financial markets based on your narratives. Well, I think the game changed. It got a lot harder back in June, you know, in and around the June FOMC pivot, when that was the first indication of tightening non-MMT Fed. And since then, it's been a lot more difficult, a lot more challenging for investors to understand style factor dispersion, to understand commodity market dispersion, to understand, you know, fixed income sector dispersion, and really, you know, actually take advantage of those things in a material profitable way. And so, you know, in terms of, you know, going back to this discussion about WTI, Most investors don't understand that. When you're in stagflation, the crude oil has a negative expected value if you're talking about deep stagflation where growth is slowing meaningfully. When you're talking about growth accelerating or slowing modestly, then crude oil has a positive expected value. So very much crude oil could be pricing in a sharper decline in economic activity as a function of Omicron, kind of really spreading and catching on like wildfire here in the States and here in the global economy. So that's something to be aware of. We back tested everything that ticks through all these different angles, speed of growth, speed of inflation. What's the Fed doing? What's the fiscal policy doing? All that stuff is sort of programmed into our portfolio construction process. And so, that's in our opinion, that's what the crude oil markets are signaling. That's what equity markets are signaling is you could either have a deeper slowdown in a stagflationary macroeconomic environment, which we call inflation, or that stagflationary macroeconomic environment could actually be pivoting towards something that resembles more like deflation as a function of COVID dynamics getting way out of control over the next kind of 6 to 8 weeks. So that's to be determined, that's to be learned. But more importantly, the most important part of this process is not to guess. You have a compendium of market-based indicators that'll tell us to dial up or dial down the risk. And so I look forward to updating those models tomorrow morning.
Like the Fed, Darius, you remain data dependent. Boy, that's such a great place to leave it. Such a great...
Can I interject?
Yes, please.
We're data dependent in a forward-looking manner. They're data dependent in a backward-looking manner. We're trying to make money in financial markets. I think they're just trying to keep it propped up.
Perfect place to leave it. Darius, always a pleasure to have you on the show, but especially great insights here today. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ash. Appreciate you guys.
Thanks again for watching the Real Vision Daily Briefing. Maggie will be here tomorrow with Stephen Van Meter. And as always, the conversation continues on the exchange. Stay tuned for a clip of the takeover. Thanks for joining us, everybody. We'll be right back.